I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we are discussing The Wife, a drama starring Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce, directed by Bjorn Runger, whom we'll be hearing from later in the show. I'm Sam Howlett, and joining me this week, a woman who, she nearly missed her train on the way here today. She got there in the end, though. It was a close one, a Glenn Close one. It's Kelly Powell.
Oh, God. Hello.
Hi.
I love it.
And also joining us today, a man who drives a hard bargain. Hard bargain to get him on the show, but luckily for us, the price was right. The Jonathan Pryce. It's Stephen Ryder.
Hi, everybody.
Stretching it today, man.
But yeah.
Wow.
I was going to save those jokes for later in the show.
No.
But then I thought, get them out of the way in the intro.
You must have been really eager. Yeah. Gems like that.
I had the Glenn Close one since I saw the film. Since before I saw the film.
Well, you know, they call her, in the industry, they call her Glenn Close Up. Because she's so good at, you know, being filmed in a close up because of that amazing face.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you're not the only one with the puns, Sam.
So before we hear from Bjorn Runger, let's talk a bit about the film. So The Wife sees Glenn Close as Joan Castleman and Jonathan Pryce as John Castleman. John Castleman has just been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. He's an extremely famous writer, and the film follows them and their son, played by Max Irons, as they go to Stockholm for John to collect the Nobel Prize. But during their trip, some past secrets come to light and paint their seemingly happily relationship in a different light. Initial thoughts, guys, what were you expecting from the film, and what did you get from the film after you first saw it?
Well, I went into this with actually quite low expectations, I have to say, which is my fault. We were sent to watch it, me and Kelly watched it together, and in all honesty, the title of the film doesn't quite... It's very succinct. It's kind of bland, in a way, until you see the film and you realise why it's called this. But I didn't go into it with the highest of expectations. In all honesty, I was kind of blown away by it. I think it's a really smart film. It's got one of the tightest scripts that I can remember in a long time. And the kind of narrative proportion is just so smooth and well-rounded. And it manages to set out, it's a very, very clever structure of a film as well, in that you immediately after the film is finished, you do want to watch it again because these characters are so well written and have so many layers that you can't help but feel like you've missed something the first time around, but in a good way, in the fact that you do want to revisit this story and kind of catch up on the things that you missed. So I was very, very impressed by it.
Yeah, similarly, I hadn't heard of it and I didn't know much about it, but with a title like The Wife, you can sort of make assumptions about what it's going to be about, and it kind of is about that, but in a very, very complex and deep way that I think the film delves into in like a masterful way, in my opinion. I think that I loved it even more the second time I watched it, and I think that Yeah, I'm glad that I had no expectations, because it also kind of, I remember walking out of the cinema and Stephen and I just looked at each other and we were like, I love that one. I think
I might
film,
have turned
yeah.
to you being like, yeah, I thought that was like kind of amazing.
Because
it is one of those films that's not, it's not doing a lot of stuff with kind of innovation or kind of really blatant kind of...
It's not trying to be clever for clever's sake.
No.
I feel like everything is in service to the story, mm-hmm. which is rare, I think, these days.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
everything has to have a gimmick and everything has to have, you know, something, yeah. a sellable point. But I think really... And I mean, this movie's, you know, Glenn Close has been attached to the project for like 20 years or something like that. And they've been trying to have this made for that long. And I think that you can feel it. It's a project that, like, they're all very invested in. And I think that, like, you know, the story, the way that, as you said, the way that it's written and adapted, because it's an adaptation from a book, feels really authentic and, like, that a lot of care has gone into this movie. Care and passion. And
that makes sense. I didn't know that she'd been attached to the project for 20
ages,
years. So that feels like a character that's been brewing in her mind
for a long
time.
Yeah,
they managed to close a deal.
I think it's the right time, though. I think it's... I'm glad that it came this late because I think she's like... She needed to be this person now, this at this age, to play this role in this way, I think. You know?
Yeah, I think the thing that I love about the film, because I've seen people call it a dark comedy, which I don't get that. For me, this film is fully like, it's a serious drama. It's got some light moments, but it's a serious drama with very sincere, honest, serious things to say that aren't ironic and cheeky or anything like that. It's very straightforward and really genuine.
Yeah,
I think that's the incorrect label, I think. But I did ask Bjorn about that because I found moments of that film hilarious. Mm-hmm. I was crying with laughter for some of them. But the very secondary characters, I think. That's a sort of, just for sort of tone and pace, I think it's important. And he said that, you'll listen to the interview, but he did say that... it's about life, you know, and life is full of ups and downs.
Well, let's hear from the man himself then. This is Kelly speaking to the director of The Wife, Bjorn Runge.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Bjorn Runge. Did I say that correctly?
Perfect.
Okay. Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. And we're here to talk about your latest film, The Wife. If I'm not mistaken, is it your first English-speaking film? You've made?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
But I've been working in the film industry in Scandinavia since the 80s, so I'm not unexperienced.
No, of course, but your first English. Well, congratulations on a marvelous film.
Thank you.
I thought it was phenomenal. It's so layered and complex, and it's stayed with me since I've seen it, so it's always a mark of a really good film, in my opinion. So I guess a good place to start would be with how the project, you know, came to you, or how you found the project. I know that Glenn Close has been attached to the project for about 5 years, I think she said.
Yes.
And so how did the material come to you, and what about it jumped out?
It comes to me early 2014, 4 years ago, and I got the chance to read the script. Not the book, the script adapted by Jane Anderson. And I fell in love with that script after one reading. It was something I could understand the universe of what the script was describing. So for me, it was easy the next day to say to the producers that I want to be a part of this. And the following 3-4 weeks, I was in a conversation nearly on a daily basis with the three female producers of the film. And we were talking and talking and talking. And one day they said that we want you to direct this film, but now it's up to Glenn Close to say yes or no to you. So I flew over to New York to have a breakfast with Glenn Close in Greenwich Village. And I was having that breakfast with her, and we were talking about the script, and we were talking about theater, and it was very easy to talk with her. It was like you know her in one way. And at one point, we were also explaining for each other why we were emotional connected to the script. And after a while, she went silent and she looked at me, and then she said, I want you to direct this film. So that's how I was involved.
That's incredible. Okay, so both Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce play their characters with such depth and complexity that it renders their characters really believable and very authentic. So I wanted to ask you about your process working with actors and developing the characters. Did you rehearse much beforehand?
We rehearsed for 1 week up in Glasgow, where we shot the film. And there was also Jane Anderson involved. So we rewrite some scenes. And we also talk every character. We talked about the characters, and we talked about the storylines and what the scenes was about. And at the same time, we did makeup tests and screen tests and different clothes tests. So it was a very intensive week before the shooting. So we lay a ground, a level, you know, a ground floor for it there. But for me, it's so important then that the actors realize that me and my team are there to taking care of their acting energy in the best way.
Yes.
So I try to create an atmosphere of trust on the set, that we are free to be free. And for me, it's all about collecting emotional material into the editing.
Okay.
And when they realized after a few days that we were there we took really care about their acting energy in a really good way. And when they understood this, they just opened the doors and something magical happens between them.
Yes.
And the best was that the camera was there also.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Great. It's a testament to the performances as well as your directing that I could feel as the story unfolded, the power dynamics were always shifting and fluid between the two characters. You know, as the story elements, you know, pieces of the puzzle get laid out without ruining anything, that by the end of the film, these two people are not the people that you thought they were at the beginning. And, you know, both Joe and Joan are complex characters in the sense that then both, neither are perfect, and they both made sacrifices and compromises in one way or another. And I wanted to know from you how you towed the line between those two characters throughout the film without taking one side or another.
First we have the script, you know, and then we do the shootings, but the whole balance act is made in the editing. Because there is very much, should that line wasn't being there, or should they do that scene, or should we put that scene in front of the other scene? So it's so much to build up attention through the editing. And so the audience don't know what's happening, but they can emotionally feel what's happening and follow what's happening, but they can't predict what will happen later on.
Definitely.
So it's a very delicate balance there.
Yeah.
But it's all in the editing.
All in the editing.
Yeah. So we shoot, you know, we shot the film for 32 days. And then we edit it for 5-6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. So just quickly, I heard that you shot this movie with two cameras on set, and I wanted to ask you, you know, is it something that you often do, and how is your process working with the two cameras?
I have a wonderful cinematographer, Ulf Brantos. He's also from Sweden. We worked together for a long time. And this time we said that let's try with two cameras. Because with two cameras, if you don't have a leading camera, but you make both cameras to leading cameras, then the actors will always know that they are in a frame and they act in another way. Then we also can cover up longer sceneries. So we could be in one room with one camera, and when they went into the another room, we had another camera there. So we make long takes, and we took it from the top to the bottom, and that made also the actors that were feeling that like they were on a stage. So Glenn told me yesterday, Glenn Close, that the final scene that is so intensive,
yes.
She didn't know where the cameras was, and we had two cameras in that room. And she said it felt like it was just me and Jonathan there, but wow, it was a big team, and it was two cameras, and it was the light was shifting and everything. Mm. But she didn't know. And for me, that's a very good note from her to us.
Yes.
Because I want them to be free, you know?
Exactly.
And the two cameras helped us.
Yeah.
So they could never realize which camera is the leading camera, because the two cameras was everywhere, yeah, actually. And we took the takes. One take we could... do you say take?
Take, yeah.
Yeah. One take we could do 10 times, you know.
Okay.
And then we shift the cameras all over the place. Wow.
You could really feel it. You felt very... It felt as though we were really a fly on the wall in this dynamic space where they were having this climactic argument at the end, you know? Yeah. And you can feel that that they were living those experiences, and it draws you in such a huge way. That's just mine. Yeah. okay, so I know that you've worked with many great directors, including Roy Anderson, and I wanted to know who's influenced you and your work the most over the years?
Roy Anderson, he was a very great person in my life in the 80s and 90s. But I wasn't so influenced by his way to film. I could be influenced by his way to observe people.
Yeah.
But for me, if you do a combination of Jane Campion,
mm-hmm,
John Cassavetes,
yes,
and Ingmar Bergman,
oh, wow,
I think you have something that haven't done a great impress on me,
yes,
as a director. But I hopefully have a voice that's not, you can't really feel the inspirations, mm-hmm, because I feel that every film is about the form you build up, is very much about the script and the word we are going to film. So in this case, I could be inspired by some scenes in Autumn Sonata by Ingmar Bergman,
mm-hmm,
and also some scenes in Love Stream by John Cassavetes.
Okay, yeah, great. So there are many comedic moments in the film, and I wanted to ask why it's important for you to include some of those in a film like as dramatic as this.
I love when... even if it's very dramatical, I think a fine life is comical in one way, even if it's very sad, yeah, moments can be rule your existence, then the humor and the comical aspect is very important for me.
Yeah, I love those moments. Yeah. I love them, they're amazing. Mm. Even just the release, you know, because there's so much tension in the film that just the moment of relief, you like almost get to take a breath and then, you know, you can be plunged back into it. Okay, so speaking of editing, we mentioned how important editing is to you earlier, but I've heard that your editor, Lena, is also your wife and longtime collaborator.
Yeah, we actually met in an editing room 31 years ago.
Oh, wow.
At the film school in Stockholm.
Oh, wow, brilliant. Yeah. So how important is, you know, your relationship with her, and how does it factor into this particular story, you know, of... this husband and wife team?
I would say that we are never married in the editing room.
Okay.
So it's very much to be professional in the best way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think they were a little bit scared of that, the producers before, to have a married couple in the editing room, because it can be very tough to come in between us, but it's not about that.
Mm.
She's a very good observer,
mm-hmm,
and she's also a therapist. She has she's working as a therapist in Sweden. So
okay,
she's good at reading people's psychological behaviors.
Yes.
Yeah. So for me, it's just as with Ulf that I've worked with for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very good and effective triangle
between the three of you.
Yeah. So I'm very glad for that.
That's amazing. Yeah. So I'd like to explore the time in which the story is set, in the 90s, you know, with particular regards to the Nobel Prize, in which, you know, Joe is up for receipt. Why do you think it was set in the 90s, and what, as opposed to perhaps the present day, and you know, how does that factor into the story?
I think it was easier because the film is set before the cell phone took over the world. Well, not only the cell phone, but the mini computer we have in our hands, yes, hours per day. So it's, and in the book written by Meg Wolitzer,
yes,
it's set in the middle of 90s, yes, I think. So when you get little distance in time, it's easy to tell you a fairy tale in one way. And then it was also the flashback should go back before the woman's movements in the 60s,
yes,
is the late 50s and the early 60s. Mm. So in one way, I think for me it was a freedom to have that distance in time. So you were not up to date when it comes to the technique and the how easy it is to find information about other people on the net and so.
Yes.
So it was not far away, but far away enough to give us a freedom when we talk about this family. And I always love when a script has a little bit distant. It can also be distant into the future.
Yeah.
Because the present time is so strange, because what's present, when we shot this film, we didn't know anything about the Me Too movement.
Yes, yes,
and
exactly.
Suddenly the Me Too movement was coming up and also reflecting into our film in a very strange way.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, you know, obviously this, you know, this role is an amazing role for Glenn Close. It's so, this woman is so well-rounded and complex, and you know, she has flaws, and you explore that in such an amazing way in your film. And obviously that is, you know, being picked up, your film and this role is being picked up in the Hollywood industry, for example, as something to be lauded, because, you know, there's a severe lack of these kinds of roles for women. And I think it is also playing into this Me Too movement, and people are starting to become, you know, aware, thank God, about how we should be seen. But I wanted to ask you if you thought about these kinds of things whilst you were making the film, you know, or reading this kind of part, if you foresaw in any kind of way this film being heralded as something to...
No, we didn't foresaw anything in one way, because we shot it before the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. And when it came, I think everyone was surprised, because so much shadow it was in many, not only in the film industry, but in many different professions in our societies.
Yeah.
So, and in Sweden, it was really also earthquake in one way, because we said that we were the most equal country on the planet.
Yeah.
And suddenly, industry after industry went out and talked about all these things that have happened in the shadow land. So in that way, I think the film is have a strange timing to come now, even if it's not about Me Too in one way, but it touches to it. It's it touches something. You think so too?
Yeah, definitely. It's got that electricity that runs through it that you can feel.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's great timing as well.
Yeah.
And as I said, you know, this film sort of stays with you.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, when you go in and do the film, you just are dealing with human beings. So for me, it's so much about what happens between those human beings. Mm. And for me, it was also a triangle between the mother, father, and son.
Son, yeah. Exactly.
So
yeah.
The son was very important for me.
Yeah, I have a question about that. Yeah. So Max Irons plays David Castleman, who's a somewhat troubled son, and he's also an aspiring writer. So it adds a very, very interesting dynamic to the parental relationship, the relationship in their marriage, and also obviously with him. So what is it about this father-son sort of parent relationship, this triangle that you were talking about, that intrigued you?
For me, it's the son is paying this price for the family secret. And he was a key for me So when I read it, I understand that the sun is very important, and I think it's so beautiful, adapted by Jane Anderson, because in the novel, the sun is not following to the award ceremony, but in the script, he's following. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because when you have a child that is suffering from something, it's something else, because it's within the family, within the group.
Exactly. Private.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think he was... And I'm asked Jane to make him a little bit more aggressive also. So the father, in one way, was a little bit afraid for him. Because he is tracking the truth.
Yeah.
The son, he smells that something is rotten in the state of that Casterman house.
Yes.
So he's the Hamlet character in this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And at the same time, when I read the script the first time, I was doing a stage production in Stockholm, Death of a Salesman.
Okay.
And, you know, it's about a son, Biff Luhmann, that don't trust his father, Willy Luhmann.
Yes.
And the mother that tried to keep the family together, Linda Luhmann. So it was the same triangle there as it is in the wife.
Yes.
And that was also very interesting for me.
Yeah, those parallels.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think children is always, that's important. The big thing. They are not alone. They have their son with them.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And it shows you a different side to each of them, I think, as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's their private family circle, but even within that, there's another element, you know, just them... The relationship between Joe and Joan changes when David is in the picture as well. So it's multi-layered.
Yeah.
I thought that was fascinating. And also, I mean, without spoiling anything, I think it for me, it spoke to something about, you know, the sort of idea of masculinity, and especially that the male artist, you know, and the passing down of those sort of ideas through the generations, and it's very patriarchal, and how, you know, David wants acknowledgement from his father, and it doesn't really mean anything coming from his mother.
No.
And the way that they play with that, the dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when he finally comes in with criticism on the little piece that the son has written, the father is it's hard criticism. He's hard to him there.
Yeah.
Because in the ways the son has written something that is very close to his parents' life.
Yes.
And he's so cruel in one way, I think, there.
Father.
Father.
Joe, yeah.
Yeah, Joe.
Yeah, and I think he sees very much of it, you know, because we see the flashbacks as well, and we see how he was sort of criticized back in the day. And her sort of empathy when she says to him in the car, you know, everybody wants to be acknowledged.
Yeah, exactly. You know? There is also a phenomenon in Sweden called the cultural man.
Okay.
And it's about the genius, you know,
often
males,
mm-hmm.
that can go into a room and take all the air that is there and talk and never ask a question, you know.
Yeah.
And this is a little bit about that kind of man. I love Jonathan Pryce's performances in this film, but it's still about that type of masculinity,
yes,
as you said.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting that we are also dealing with that in this film.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That those perceptions.
Yeah.
We're running out of time, so let me ask you the one question at the end.
Mm.
I'll just read it because it's a bit long. Sorry about that. Okay, so the story is one that challenges the concept of accepted truths and morality on many levels and explores societal norms and perceptions in depth between a husband and a wife, artist and the public, parents and children, masculinity and femininity, as well as the role of a man and a woman in both the home and the workplace. And it's a film that stays with you, as I said, and it's bound to spark a dialogue in audiences. So what would you like audiences to take away from the film?
For me, the truth is a key to healing, even if it's painful. You can't choose. You must follow the road. So the truth is very important for a better life. even if it's very painful. Mm. And that's, I think, it's what the audience will get.
I agree. And just finally, what's next for you? What's any projects in the works?
I read a lot of scripts, and I'm developing some own ideas, both original ideas and reading a lot of books also. So I have a lot of things going on, but nothing is decided for the future.
Okay.
But I'm looking forward to my next film.
Great, me too. I'm too. Thank you so much for sitting down and talking with me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you.
And congratulations once again on this film.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, so when these kind of films come out, they are sort of sold and presented to us around a performance. And everyone is talking about Glenn Close in this film. And I do think sometimes, you know, it's like, when Blue Jasmine came out, everyone was just talking about Cate Blanchett all the time. But I think she is amazing. I think there is a lot else going on in the film as well, though, that we do need to talk about. But let's start with Glenn Close, because she is incredible.
Yeah, just a fantastic performance from beginning to end. This is an actor who is so in control of her character. The performance itself is very good. She's very good at kind of the emotional moment. She's good at kind of exploding. She's good at the quiet kind of anger that you see like seething inside her. But more than anything, throughout the whole film, she gets lost in this role because she knows this character inside out. She seems to have gone over and over and over in her head, scene by scene, how this character would react to certain situations, the emotions that she's going to be feeling. And it all feels like it comes from a very raw and honest place, like something that this is a subject that clearly she believes in. Mm-hmm. And I think that Glenn Close in this role is a really, I mean, if she's been attached to it for 20 years, that makes sense. But it's a really smart casting move because she feels like a matriarch. Mm-hmm. She feels like the kind of head of a family, somebody that's keeping a family afloat. And obviously with the certain aspects of the film that we'll talk about a bit later, that whole thing gets turned on its head and you get to see Glenn Close act in a different way that's kind of almost against type. And I thought that was absolutely fantastic. Really smooth performance.
Yeah. I mean, she's absolutely so... She sucks you into this film in a very quiet... She's so quietly powerful. And I think that, again, I think you need to watch it again. Like, after watching it the first time, you go back and you watch it the second time and you see the subtleties that she... The way that she plays this role is just genius.
Mm-hmm.
Slight changes here and there, the way that she and the way that her character sort of comes out as things sort of things happen around her that brings out triggers different thoughts and memories which come in the form of flashbacks. And you sort of can see two stories unfolding before you.
I think you know when a performance is good that when the flashbacks happen in this film, her presence or lack of presence is felt like almost immediately.
Yeah.
Like, you know that it's good when you are watching the screen and you suddenly realize, oh, Glenn Close hasn't been on screen for 5 minutes, like, when's she going to be back? And you want that character back, and you want that actor back on screen, because she's been the one that's kind of been holding you, holding your attention for this entire film. And I think it's that kind of performance. It's like very similar to Blue Jasmine, actually. I think it's a really apt comparison, in that you've got a very layered, complicated character that Kate Blanchett plays, that you really can't take your eyes off. Super charismatic.
Sure, yeah.
But at the same time, I think a lot of her performance relies on Jonathan Pryce's partnership in her scenes, because I think that he was also incredible.
100%.
It's like totally incredible. And the way that they play off each other, you know.
We're not hearing much about his performance, but I think Kelly's right to bring it up, because it starts with that opening scene, which is a really, really bold.
So this opening scene is when he wakes up in the middle of the night and then wants to have sex with her.
Yeah. Right. And for a film about kind of two people in their 70s, in their late 60s and early 70s, to have such a... I was speaking to Kelly off mic earlier and I called it graphic. And it's not graphic, but it's intimate, you said.
Yeah.
You said it was intimate. And I think that's the right word to use. Yeah, yeah. Like, it's so emotionally intimate that you feel uncomfortable watching it. Not because it's two older people, but because it's just two fantastic actors who almost immediately make you feel as though they've been husband and wife
for
you know, half a century.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
Yeah. And they're drawing the audience into their marital bed. That's what the whole story is sort of hinged on, is like you being invested in their marriage and their relationship.
I hadn't thought about that, actually, but you'd think that with the opening scene being a kind of a sex scene, a very intimate sex scene, that it wouldn't get any more emotionally intimate than that. But you'd be wrong, because it does. It gets so much more kind of uncomfortable and emotionally uncomfortable the longer you spend with these two characters.
The tension just builds from
there. Yeah, and because they do such a good job of convincing you they've been together for so long, you do feel it's almost voyeuristic at times, that you feel as though you're watching something unfold that you shouldn't be. Like, this is a very, very personal kind of situation that they're going through. And I think that's such a testament to how tense the film can get at points.
I wouldn't put Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce together even before I saw this film. Like, in my head, that doesn't fit. They're two very, very different actors. They look completely different to each other. They have different styles of acting. It just doesn't feel right in my head. But then you're right, this first scene is like, and that's fine.
Yeah,
it'll be fine.
Yeah, makes complete sense. Yeah.
What do you think of when you think of Glenn Close? Like, what's the role that you really associate her with before this?
That's Cruella, right?
Like, for me, it's Cruella. Yeah.
My generation.
I think Cruella does as well.
You know, I think she's kind of she's always been quite a difficult actress to pin down, if I'm going to be honest. I think she's just got such striking features. And obviously, when she was younger, she was in the Michael Douglas film.
Fatal Attraction.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, apart from 101 Dalmatians, that was my first kind of
I think that's the role that she's most sort of famous for.
Yeah.
And that was a huge film when it came out, like major film. And her role in that is really interesting compared to her role in this, I think.
It's almost a U-turn, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
I think she's expressed kind of slight regret.
I think that film has had I really like that film, but I love those kind of almost sort of... I love like trashy films that sort of sneak into like mainstream cinema.
Like
B-movies that people actually mistake for mainstream films.
Exactly.
But I do think that film's had a kind of... People are re-looking at that film and re-examining the gender politics of that film. But I think the film still works, even if you do question...
It's a very complicated film.
She's basically the crazy other woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's wronged. In a way.
I was listening to her to this interviewer, and she was speaking specifically about this role, and she was saying that, like, the way that she read the character, she was, like, totally drawn to the script immediately, but the way that she read it was that this person is, her mental health is in decline, and she's sick. She needs help.
Fatal Attraction.
She actually needs help. She's crying out for help.
Yeah.
And the thing that she wasn't happy about in the beginning, when it came out, was they'd rewrote the ending.
Yes, the ending's different.
That's what she was adamantly against, redoing the ending.
When she becomes a killer, right? Mm-hmm.
She was so adamant that the character was not a psychopath, she was just mentally ill and she needed help, and she was like, it goes against the grain of the character.
Should have been a film that brought that kind of thing into the mainstream.
It didn't become too early.
I know that men still come up to her and say, like, oh, your performance in that made me, like, not want to cheat on my wife. And she was like, well, that's not why you shouldn't want to cheat with
me. Yeah, exactly. It's part of the dialogue, isn't it? The bunny boiler.
Mm. Yeah.
A crazy woman is a bunny boiler. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So the role in the wife seems, like, completely different to that. I mean, this is a film about a complicated woman still, one that's, like...
I think it's coming at a time where it's, Fatal Attraction came out and, like, not much had been spoken about. I think the role of women and all too easy to name the woman as crazy, the place of a woman in society is sort of, it developed. Mm-hmm. I think, and we've come to, I think, appreciate women in different roles in the industry. And now I think that with this character, it's almost a reflection on that kind of thing. But she's treated, like, the character is treated in a way that is, I mean, she's not a totally sympathetic character. There are moments, I mean, we spoke about this, like, when they have their arguments, just like in any marriage, you sort of flit between, oh, I agree with that point. I agree with that point on this side and that side. And she isn't, like, totally sympathetic at all times. But she's complex, and they don't try and hide that.
I love that she has an ego. Exactly. I don't think that's something we see often enough with women in cinema, that she has a huge ego and she wants to be recognized for, like, for who she is.
Yeah.
And I think that she kind of really fights against that a lot. And she pushes back against it, but ultimately she can't get over the fact that she needs to be recognised. And I think that comes out in the amount of, you feel the, like, repression on her shoulders in this film of that character.
Mm.
And when everything kind of spills over, it's just so kind of intense. Yeah.
All right, so we're going to talk about some, like, third act revelation stuff here now. So if you haven't seen the film and want to go in cold, then... thank you for listening.
Come back after you've seen the film.
Come back after you've seen the film, yeah. Because I think the stuff we're going to be talking about now is... It will...
I would prefer not to know, but, I mean, it doesn't ruin the film. There's so many layers. There's so many layers to
it's
this
It's not
film.
Like a twist film or anything.
No.
So we've spoken about this,
and this is what me and Kel has really liked.
Okay,
about
from here on out, we're going to be talking about what happens in the end, okay?
Yeah.
Go.
So I remember.
I didn't think you'd be a ghost.
This.
I didn't.
I love the fact that this doesn't have a twist in it. There isn't a sudden revelation.
Mm.
It's passed out in, like, tiny, smaller scenes.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you slowly realize what. Basically, it turns out that that she has actually been the one that's been writing all these books for years and years and years. And
she's just won the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's the bottom line,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
She's the one that's won the Nobel Peace Prize, but because of this
prize for literature.
Because she, when they were younger, the only way that she could get these novels published were under a man's name, which we get to see in flashbacks. She's had to live this lie throughout her whole life. But you don't get to see, him suddenly turn around and be like, oh, you were the one that wrote these books. Like, it's smaller, subtle things until you get to the point where you're like, well, she clearly wrote these books. And it's not explicitly said till, I think, quite late
it's
on
the
in the film.
It's the scene there with Christian Slater.
Yeah.
So Christian Slater plays Nathaniel Bone. First of all, Christian Slater plays a character called Nathaniel Bone. I want a spin-off just called Bone.
You could do a spin-off, man. He's great.
Bone. Nathaniel Bone.
Just Bone.
And you're like, the way he sort of creeps up from the back of the plane. Like,
oh, my God.
Hey, guys. Hey, yeah.
That was so
funny. We turned to each other. That's what could make this a dark comedy. We just turned to each other and laughed as soon as he came on screen. And I had no idea why I found it so funny.
I found it. Because I saw it with Kelly after she'd already seen it.
Yeah.
And
was she giggling?
When they're on the plane and the air hostess goes, oh, excuse me, someone called Nathaniel Bone wants to see you. Kelly sort of looked at me like, just sort of gave me a look like basically like, get ready for this kind of thing. And I was like, what? And then it's Christian, so I was like, yeah!
the real Oscar winning performance of this film, I think.
Best actress, Christian Slater.
When you watch it the second time, you can see him in the background coming up. I wonder what he's like.
What's he doing? Is he just looking, like, peering over the seat?
He's like asking the air hostess.
Like, over yet?
He really, really like buys into this role.
But it is
through Christian Slater, obviously, that we slowly get told about. He's the conversation that they have over dinner or drinks in the bar is the turning point of the film.
And that's a really lovely scene. And she's doing a different performance in that scene as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She doesn't play that character again.
So the thing is, I think what we really liked about it the first time we watched it was that we thought we knew what was happening at every moment, but then we were proved wrong.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, you think, oh, I get it. I get what's happening. They wrote it together. Or, mm-hmm. I understand what's happening, that he wants to, you know, get the scoop, and like she's gonna be the one to, like, actually her oppression has got the better of her and she's gonna blow out and do this whole cover. And not at one moment does any of that come true. It really sticks to the spine of the story, which is this woman coming to terms with, you know, how she's lived her life. And not only that, but like, not only as a wife, but as a mother, as a writer, as a partner. And same for him, you know, like, I think that what we really liked about this was that it kind of plays with role reversals in a really interesting way,
mm-hmm.
because, and you start to realize that they both have made sacrifices throughout their lives, their marriage, their careers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think that the best flashback is at the end, when you really see that she is writing the book, you know, and he is taking care of the children.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a point to be made that, like, you know, he sacrificed as much as she did, mm-hmm. you know, in different ways. And I think that those role reversals are very interesting.
Yeah. And this idea of ego as well that I was talking about, if you see things from the husband's perspective, His behavior throughout the film, he can be quite lecherous. He can kind of, he hits a lot on younger women who like him because of his genius that doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
Which is it's really like layered.
That's really interesting.
Like, odd character. Yeah. And I think because he knows, he's the only one in the world that knows that his wife has been writing these novels, he has such a fragile ego. And this is the reason why he goes after these younger women.
Well, that's the excuse that he uses.
The excuse that he uses too.
It
is a reason though. That's
it is,
you
yeah,
look at him and
yeah.
you think
his masculinity,
you know,
is
yeah, it's under attack.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's the only one that knows it.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
he has to like lash out in these kind of awful ways.
That seems generic to the norm, to the outside world. Is like, oh, classic genius writer, adulteress. You know?
Oh, well, yeah, let him off, kind of thing. Like it's hard to be a genius.
Yeah,
exactly.
But there's something so kind of slimy
about
the idea that he's using his wife's genius to seduce these
women. Yeah, exactly.
You know,
it's
like,
gross.
It's gross.
It
also makes sense because of the ego thing. So it's this super, like, his character is just as layered as hers.
Well,
and the film doesn't ignore that.
No, it doesn't. Yeah.
And that's what's so good, that it manages to balance out these two primary characters without falling, you know, on a judgment on either side of them. Mm. You get to see equally how both of these people feel.
Yeah, and in the same way that his affairs spurred her on to write, gave her material, basically, mm-hmm. and his behavior gave her material.
And
didn't
he use
like
that against her? He's like,
yeah, he did,
well,
yeah.
you wouldn't have come up with any of these books
exactly.
if it wasn't for me being an
asshole.
Exactly,
so it's almost like...
it wasn't for me being... whatever.
This toxic toxic symbiosis that they've created for themselves.
Yeah. No, it's this is what I mean when I say it's such a tight, layered script.
Mm.
Just really, really smart and clever.
Mm.
Did Bjorn Runge write this as well?
No.
It was written by Jane Anderson, based on a novel
by give a man a woman.
Meg Wolitzer. So written by a woman and adapted by a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, because women are better.
No, it does. It does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct
Jane
me if I'm
Anderson,
wrong,
mm.
but
the name.
There's no... They don't talk about... Yeah, they don't talk about in private the fact that she's the writer until she confronts him about it.
Yeah.
So it's as if the past 30 years, it's just kind of been, it's just sort of forgotten mm-hmm. that she, even between them,
mm-hmm.
it's forgotten.
It's unwritten,
it's
yeah.
just, they never talk about it. And maybe every now and then she'll think about it. But I mean, maybe he generally does think he's the writer.
Wow.
Well, he believes that he
Stockholmed himself.
Yes. Yeah.
Where's the film set? Oh my god.
I think they do, but they both believe that they need each other. That's the thing, is that they kind of do.
He genuinely believes that it's not that bad, that she's not the sole writer. He thinks that it is a kind of weird collaboration between them.
Well, that, and he also allowed her to be the writer because he took care of the children and he rubbed her back.
It's unsure what the divide is. Like, is it literally she's written the entire thing? And it's just his name, because I've only seen it once, I'm not sure. Or is it more like he'll write something and then she'll rewrite completely, like do a rewrite of it, and then he'll go back and say, oh no, let's do that.
You never really know.
It's not really clear.
Well,
is it?
I think...
Apart from that one flashback, that is kind of like the most important flashback.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's the thing, is that all the way through, even as it's unfolding that she had more and more to do with his writing, you never quite understand, I think, in my view, till the end, that she actually had more to do with the books than he ever did. Mm. I think that he kind of was her sounding board and sort of probably edited some of the stuff.
Yeah.
But in that moment when, you know, he says, you go on too long here, and she like sort of justifies herself, you're like, oh, she's the brains behind
it.
Yeah,
yeah. Oh, it's, I mean, 100% she's the brains. I'm just not sure what the... Is it literally story? She's written everything and then he's been, great, thanks.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all, what you're talking about there all comes to the head in what I think might be my favourite scene in the film, which is his speech, acceptance speech prize. When he speaks directly to her from the stage. And you know what? Like, confesses that she's the writer in a roundabout way.
Yeah.
But nobody really like understands what he's saying, because it sounds like he's thanking his wife for always being there.
Yeah.
He sits there and says, doesn't he say, like, you were the one that wrote these books? You were the one that was there with me the whole time. Sounds like metaphorical. And they think it's a metaphor, but he's there and he's trying actually really hard to give her a moment. But obviously it's not good enough.
It's a real backhanded one.
Yeah, it's a backhanded one. She's still the one looking up at him on a stage. He's still the one getting the applause.
Oh, and she specifically asked him not to do that.
Yes, she does.
And he did it anyway.
But I think that's him really trying hard to give her something when he knows that really he's unable to give her anything.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really well, from both actors, from him 50 feet away on the stage to her.
Yeah, you're right. The staging of that.
Clever scene. Just the both of them staring at each other.
There's two moments. There's a moment when he gets the award where he doesn't have a speech. He just bows. And he does the whole bowing thing, ceremony.
Yeah.
And then he bows to the audience, and it's as if he's bowing to her, and then that close up happens, and she's having this sort of, she's going through this inner turmoil, and then at the like after party or whatever, they're having dinner, and then that's the speech, and her sort of fury is so palpable in that, because she'd asked him specifically, don't thank me in your speech, and he kind of was like, from your perspective, it's interesting to hear from your perspective, like he's trying to give her something.
Yeah.
But I read it as though, like, that's the nail that, like, sealed.
Well, it did.
I think, for me,
there's, like, she was explicit in the way. Because it's also, sorry, I'm babbling now, but I really love this film. There's lots to talk about. But it's also an interesting, I mean, the reason she's so complex is because, yes, she does have this ego. And actually, yes, it came to at the end that she kind of did need, as she says the line herself in the movie, like, every writer needs to be acknowledged or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. I think she says everybody needs acknowledgement,
something like that.
Yeah.
So she's kind of coming to terms with the fact that she has this ego and that she wants to be recognized for her own writing. But she also says that, I mean, I don't know how much of this is to do with the fact that she was deterred from being a female writer in the 60s or whenever she was studying writing because women weren't getting read or published. And also to some extent, and I think this does come out in her character, that she said she didn't have the temperament, she didn't have the personality to be a famous writer because she's shy.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't want that kind of spotlight on her per se, you know, being in the public eye all the time. So they're so multi-layered, these characters. Yeah. It's like, it is true to life because people go through the same things, you know. You don't know what you want. You want acknowledgement, but you don't want to you don't want to be famous. Like, how do you?
He's the one that spends the time at these parties, schmoozing,
loving it.
But you know, she looks at it and thinks that looks like hard work. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So in a way, she's kind of giving him that job to do, whilst she can just get on with the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fascinating stuff. And that 15 minutes of the movie, from the speech to them going out in the car.
Yeah, and when he throws the medal and then has to go and get
cried
it.
With
that's really that's really funny, that bit.
Which is a very, very funny
That's very
scene.
Funny.
And so realistic.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
when,
yeah,
you're, when you're so angry.
Oh, actually, I do want that.
When you're so angry that you throw... I mean, I can you know, relate when I get angry and I throw my Nobel Prize out of the window of my car.
I've lost so many Nobel Prizes because of my temper.
Yeah, but no, it's because it's so realistic and because in that moment that prize does seem like such a worthless thing.
Yeah.
compared to their marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but then she turns around and says, like, what are you doing? Because that's still her prize. And you throw it out the window. It's still hers. You don't make that decision. You get to make that decision whether you throw the Nobel Prize for Literature out the window of your limo. You don't get to do that.
And what do you think about how the film rounds up, how it finishes everything with him dying and his legacy remaining? And she kind of makes a promise to... Well, she tells the son that she's going to tell him everything. The whole child. They've got a daughter as well, who's just had a child.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems really nice, actually, when they have the argument and then they find out they're grandparents and then they kind of...
It's just another example of their, like...
How they keep bouncing back. Yeah,
to each other,
But she makes the decision to kind of let it bury with him, essentially.
Mm, but then she opens her notebook to a fresh new page.
I mean, I assumed she was going to tell the world.
You think?
Yeah, I also did.
Because she says to Christian Slater, like, if you... slander his name in any way and tell him anything I've told you, I'll take you to court.
Yeah, because she wants to be the one to tell the story.
This is what's so interesting.
I read it as she's letting it go. She's letting it be John Castleman, the great writer, dies and this is the end Or is she...
Does she just not want another man's name on her story?
Yeah, there you go.
Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
We don't know. But that character and what she's been through and the fact that she's about to tell her son, I think she's going to tell people.
I think so too. The end shot was a little bit...
What was the end shot?
Like her looking up and like...
Hopeful.
Hopeful.
I
really didn't like that. I think that like that's the one disappointing
I think it should have ended on Christian Slater. Just like, hey, can I order some peanuts, please? thanks, miss.
That was good.
Thank you. And then it ends. He's just like...
it finishes.
He's not even happy. He's just like, oh, well.
And then we're ready for the Bone sequel.
Yeah. Bone.
Yeah. Bag of bones. What else? What are the Bone sequels? Bones.
We haven't even spoken about the son.
No.
That's an interesting...
Yeah, it's an interesting character.
Yeah.
He's kind of a pathetic character, isn't he? But he's just kind of like desperate for his father's appraisal, and that. But all the time, he actually should have just got his mum's appraisal.
Yeah, exactly.
But me and Kels said, would he... Is this a gendered thing where if he knew his mum would have written these books, would he still been seeking his father's approval?
Yeah.
Because you know, in a way, that's what all kind of men do, is they seek their father's approval no matter how you know, impressive or, you know, intelligent their mother is.
Mm.
And I think he is going to be quite screwed up when all this...
He's looking pretty screwed up already.
Yeah, I mean, he is.
Yeah, he is.
He's not a happy boy.
Yeah.
Not a happy boy at all.
All right, do you have any final thoughts on the wife then before we wrap?
Well, what does everyone think about Oscar season? Do you think
Do
you think it's going to have those legs to kind of...
I think it will. I think it's doing really well at the limited box office in America.
Mm.
I think loads of people are seeing it. I think loads of people are talking about her. Like I said at the beginning, the main talking point from the film for everyone that's seen it is how good she is.
Mm-hmm.
The Academy love to give a kind of veteran actor and actress not only a nomination, but I think she'll definitely be I'd say she will be nominated.
Yeah.
She'll be nominated.
Whether she'll win, I don't know. I don't know who else. I mean,
we'll have to see what happens.
The favorite, I think.
Viola for Widows as well.
Widows, yeah. the trio from The Favorite are looking quite strong.
Yeah.
Mm. I don't know. Interesting, but I think she'll definitely be nominated.
Oh, yeah.
She's been nominated 6 times before.
It's odd. This is the kind of film that usually I'd be like, oh, you know, typical kind of like, it's just a drama. It's just a, you know, an Oscar film. I want to see like a kind of new, kind
a
of
weird film.
Innovative performance win, which I'd be looking at The Favourite and thinking like Olivia Colman.
Well, I thought Hereditary might have legs, but I don't think that will.
I mean, it's a great performance, but at this point, I think it got released too early.
Mm. Mm.
But I'm looking at Glenn Close. I'm thinking like, is there going to be a better performance this year?
Yeah.
Well,
like, really?
You know what it is at the moment, don't you?
Mm.
It's too close to call.
Anyway, the Oscars is quite a way away.
Yeah, we'll see.
But Glenn far away.
uh, If you've got any thoughts on The Wife or any other recent release, do let us know by emailing podcast@curzon.com for next week's show. Or you can reach out to us on Twitter at Curzon Cinemas. To coincide with The Wife, then, on Curzon Home Cinema, we have a collection called Scenes from a Marriage. That includes films such as Amour, 45 Years, and Force Majeure, all containing really interesting takes on relationships in a marriage that go really nicely with The Wife. So do check those out. So that is Goodbye from Steven Ryder.
Oh, goodbye.
You still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Goodbye from Kelly Powell.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. Thank you for listening.